Very exciting panel. The panel is going to focus mostly on the Freedom Ways readings. So I just wanted to do a little bit of a preview for you, setting the stage. Mostly drawing on the Simmons reading, but just on some other general civil rights history. So Freedom Ways was established in what year? 1961. Okay. So what's happening in 1961 in the United States? The civil rights movement. Okay. Particularly, we've already had the Montgomery bus boycott. Okay, that's happened. The sit-in movement has started. All right. Brown v. Board was a long time before that, 1954. So 1961 is really in the middle of all of the intense activities of the civil rights movement. So the civil rights movement is really rolling. We're going towards Freedom Summer. You're starting to have more interaction between black activists and white progressive activists who want to become part of the movement. The seeds of SNCC are being sown. Everybody know what SNCC is? Anybody not know what SNCC is? Okay, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Okay, I wasn't sure if in the readings that's actually spelled out, because the readings kind of patch around the book. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee grew out of the sit-in movement, and it was organized by students along with the help of Ella Baker and Fred Shuttlesworth and other seasoned activists as a committee to coordinate nonviolent protests against Jim Crow, primarily in the South, but also later in the North. Okay, so there's this very exciting intellectual atmosphere in addition to the political atmosphere, because most of these committees, the committees come out of the college campuses. All right, so you have this incredible intellectual energy happening at the same time, and people going back to consult the works of people like W.E.B. Du Bois. Okay, and Du Bois was very turned on by this movement as well. So with all this young intellectual energy and happening, and all the new kinds of protests happening, it's a very different situation than the periods we've been reading about previously in the black press. So we've basically come up through World War II, and now we're jumping into the civil rights movement. Well, during World War I and World War II, as you all remember, the black press was basically pushing for a movement, encouraging people to be more radical, encouraging people to stand up for their rights, using the double V strategy, talking about the ills in society around race, and very much on the front lines of black activism. Well, once the youth start being the generators of the movement, those who own and operate the black press, well, they're of an older generation. And so the black press starts to be repositioned to civil rights movements. So you have an older generation in the black press, you have a younger generation in SNCC and populating a lot of the movement and SCLC. You also have more southern blacks involved than northern blacks, and most of the press was concentrated in the north and in the west. Okay, so because of these trends, because of this relative generational and geographic separation from most of the major black newspapers from the movement in the South, the black press was more reacting to what was going on in the movement. And so as you saw through the Simmons readings, there's basically three kinds of reactions that arise. One is, this is great. Okay, so the Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, threw their support behind the movement. All right, and they, of course, were in the North, so their readers weren't bearing the brunt of what was going on down in the South in terms of violence and violation of people's rights. But they were supporting it, and they were trying to get more Northerners to support, and also at times encouraging Northern blacks to go down South and help fight, okay, as in with the Freedom Run. The second reaction was born out of the still very alive tradition of Booker T. Washington's accommodationism, which is, hold up, wait a minute. This protest is just going to inflame racial strife, right? And so we have Percy Green and The Advocate taking this tact. Percy Green, who had in previous generations been a little more radical, now was saying, you know, these young students, they're just being inflamed by outside agitators, by communists, and they're ruining the balance that we had achieved here in the South. And the good Negroes know that this is the wrong way to go about getting your rights. Okay? So the accommodationist stripe has a bit of a resurgence in reaction to the civil rights movement. And then there was a second, less radical accommodationist, or less, you know, shuddering accommodationist response, which was, well, protests in the streets, sit-ins, marches, these sorts of things, they do inflame racial passions, and so we don't think that's the right technique. Since Brown v. Board was successful, and since it seems that the Kennedy administration, okay, everybody knows who John F. Kennedy was, and that his brother Robert F. Kennedy was the Attorney General, right? It seemed at certain points in time that the Kennedy administration was willing to back up court rulings with federal support, whether it is sending in troops to desegregate schools or sending in federal marshals to investigate problems. There was some semblance of federal support. So some accommodationists said, let's use the courts as our main conduit for rights. And this way, no one can accuse us of inciting violence because we're using the system. We're not sitting in and making people throw stuff at us. We're not getting on buses and, you know, what they saw as inviting white racists to come and bomb buses and things like this. So that was another form of accommodationism, is that we should use the courts because that's a more civilized or a less violent form of change. And it will be slower, and it'll take time, but this is the right way to do it without too much bloodshed. Okay, so out of this atmosphere in 1961, we have a new radical, incredible journal called Freedom Waves that is started by black intellectuals and white progressives who feel that there's something missing from the black press as constituted currently. And so your group leaders will now talk about that publication.
Okay. We would like to welcome everybody to the unveiling of the new Freedom Way suit. And I'm Whitney Brad, the editor of the new paper. And I would like to give you a brief history of what Freedom Ways is about, because we today taking on the same aim that they have in the past. Freedom Ways is born of the necessity for a vehicle of communication which will mirror developments in the diversified and many-sided struggles of the Negro people. It will provide a public forum for the review, examination, and debate of all problems confronting Negroes in the United States. Freedom Ways offers a means of examining experiences and strengthening the relationship among peoples of African descent in this country, Latin America, and wherever there are communities of such people anywhere in the world. It will furnish accurate information on the liberation movements in Africa itself. Freedom Ways will explore without prejudice or gag, and from the viewpoint of the special interests of American Negroes, as well as the general interests of the nation. The new forms of economic, political, and social systems now existing or emerging in the world today. Freedom Ways provides a medium of expression for serious and talented writers, for those with established reputations, as well as beginners seeking a reading audience for the first time. Freedom Ways has no special interest to serve, save those already clearly stated, no political, organizational, or institutional ties. Those who commit themselves to its support become patrons only of a publication and editorial policy designed to provide an open forum for free expression of ideas. We openly invite historians, sociologists, economists, artists, workers, students, all who have something constructive to contribute to this search for truth, to use this as an open channel of communication that we might unite and mobilize our efforts for worthy and lasting results. With all that said, Freedom Ways is extremely grateful to those who have contributed to the magazine in tremendous ways. People like Paul Robeson, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, Langston Hughes were just a few of the supporters. W.E.B. Du Bois played a crucial role as an advisor to the magazine from the beginning. He was there from the start of Freedom Ways until his death. Now we have journalist and editor of Write On Magazine, Martine Mason, honoring him today with an article that she has written.
Okay, I'm writing an article about whether or not the issues that blacks faced in the past were problematic today. And first, I want to start off by talking about the article that Du Bois had, the first Freedom Ways, and the issues that he discussed. But I'm going to put a picture up of him. His article was published in 1961, and basically he was summarizing everything that blacks had faced from the time of slavery all the way up to the civil rights movement. So some of the issues that he talked about, well, first he hit on the fact that blacks originally or initially had no rights whatsoever. And he spoke about how slavery was illegal, it was legal and the government was bound to protect it, and how President Lincoln wasn't necessarily an enemy of it, that he supported it in the South, but he didn't want it to expand to the North. And he went on from there to talk about how neither the North or the South in the Civil War was really looking out for the interests of the slaves. And in the Civil War, blacks, they want to fight for their rights, they want to fight themselves, but the government wouldn't allow black soldiers. But eventually they joined in with the Northern armies, and slaves became what Du Bois referred to as a contraband of war, that they were property owned by the enemy or owned by the South, but the North used to help them win the war. And eventually, we know that the South surrendered, and finally there was a reason for the war, and that was the freeing of the slaves. But Du Bois mentioned that even though emancipation came, they still weren't technically free. They didn't have freedom, and they were still going to be discriminated against for years to come. And from there, he went on to talk of, well, first, let's keep a track of this here. We talked about one issue that they had no rights. Well,
you used the chalkboard actually.
They tried to obtain education, so really were educated. And he went on to talk about how, well, actually the North came in to help with that. They sent teachers down into the South. And he spoke about how there's the idea of giving every slave 40 acres and a mule and giving them the vote. The North didn't want to spread capital among them, and they didn't want to give them the vote, so they had no voting rights. No social equality, that goes along with having no rights. And basically they were thrown into a caste system, and they suffered from disenfranchisement and color caste.
Does everybody understand what caste means? Do you want to explain that, or do you want me to explain that? Caste system is where your class and your ethnic group or your religious group or whatever other kind of cultural group you're part of get collapsed together. So caste is another way of saying second class citizenship, but based on this combination of economic and cultural factors. So in India, they talk about the caste system because it's based on what region you're from, what level of society you're put in, given your religion, your economic position, and your skin color all lumped together. So Du Bois and some other sociologists like to refer to the American racial system as also a caste system because it determines so many things in your life.
Okay. And he also spoke about how there was limited employment. And then he's also talked about like the progress that was being made within like the Niagara Movement, the NAACP, and he basically jumped into, well, no, with World War One, that blacks were actually allowed to enter the war, but not as soldiers. And then by the time of World War II, they were allowed to enter the ranks of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. So he was showing like the progress that had been made. And as we know, like 1954, the Supreme Court ruled racial discrimination unconstitutional. But at the same time, it still wasn't enforced. And that led to the sit-ins, the bus strikes that were happening in Civil War. He ended Civil Rights Movement. And he ended his article by saying that it still goes on. And so a question that I really want you guys to think about is, do you think these issues, or the issues that they faced then, are they still problematic today? And in the article that I'm writing, that I wrote, it's about whether or not, in particular, the voting rights, is it still an issue today, or is it still problematic today? So if you... So if you think that this is still a problem today, I want you to...
Everybody move like over here. To this side.
If you think that it's still problematic today, I want you to cross the line and go to the other side of the room.
Voting rights.
If you're in the middle, stay in the middle. If you think it's not a problem, stay where you're on this side of the room.
So if you're unsure, you're like in the center.
If you're unsure.
If you think that blacks still face obstacles to voting rights or their ability to vote, come to this side of the room. If you believe that that is no longer a problem, stay on that side of the room. If you're not sure, stay in the middle of the room.
Okay. You're like the middlers or?
Middle.
Okay. And I just want us to discuss this, like, why are you guys in the middle and why are some of you feel that it is problematic today? Anybody?
Because we don't think about it. I just think that it's still a problem today because some of the same things that went on, like, in the past or whatever, or back when blacks were first, like, going through all the things with, like, the literacy tests or having to do all the things they had to do to vote in the first place, or things that are going now. Not that we have to take tests or whatever now or whatever, but things such as the things that they said happened in Florida or the unfairness or people not being able to, like, register to vote are still some of the problems that happened to people back before civil rights.
Okay.
I also think, like, where they set up, sometimes when they set up places to vote are not very people-friendly as to travel towards, like, depending on where you live or whatever neighborhood you're from. It's not that easy.
I think like the actual rights are there, so it's like technically blacks have the rights, but there's like all these other loopholes that they throw in, like, you know, like there's a large percentage of black males incarcerated who don't have the right to vote. So I think that they're twisting it around now and finding different ways to take your vote away or not mark it towards black.
Rights are there, but I've heard of problems with, like, people actually being turned away because polls close too early because they can't accommodate the amount of people and stuff like that. But, yeah. I think the actual rights are there, but there are loopholes in different ways that they're being cheated.
And so
it is primarily black. It's not all black. And again, I don't know a lot about it.
In addition to the things like the election board officials making like the rules of like when you can register, how you can register the people, you know, what ways the ballots may be cast, whatever, I do like the flaws in that. But I also realize coming from a place where it's dominantly black, not only like the officials are black, but there's a general apathy in the community sometimes. People, even if the poll is right there one block away, people still don't really, don't take the vote seriously too. So I also realize that, you know, whether it be misinformation, not enough education on the issues, that people don't take the advantage of regular people.
I think that kind of ties into what I was saying earlier about how they're marketed. I think if there is a sense of apathy in the community, I feel like a lot of people don't feel like their vote matters. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, you know, they're, you know what I'm saying, felt made to feel as if they're like a minority and that their vote won't.
Okay, wait, stop.
Okay,
let's
back to your original faces.
Okay, having done that, I just wanted to, you guys pretty much touched base on it though. I wanted to throw up an article about the Florida vote. You guys can see that. I'll read it.
We can just summarize it because we can't really read it.
Right. Okay, and it was entitled Race in the Florida Vote. And some of the points that it made was that a lot of minority voters had registered and came out to vote, but many of them were students, but they weren't allowed to vote, and or they were denied the chance to cast in their ballots. And some were told that they were not registered. Some did vote, but their ballots were discarded because of faulty machines or confusing instructions. And basically, some civil rights officials were saying that minorities, it was harder for members of minorities than for whites to cast their ballots, their votes. And mostly this happened in Florida. It said that a high percentage of black voters were required to use cheaper, less efficient punch card systems to register their choices, while whites needed to vote in more affluent districts with more reliable postmarking systems. And computers were not available in many black precincts to help clear up the problems that when they said that they weren't registered. And many voters they had to call it in and lines were busy, so many voters just gave up and went home. And the NCAA president said that NAACP, basketball on the rank, said that it was a voting fraud, intimidation, and irregularities. And the Voting Rights Act, enacted originally to rule out literacy tests and other efforts to keep blacks from the polls, does not require evidence of conspiracy to keep minority voters away from the polls, but instead the law is designed to protect minority voters whenever they confront more difficulties than whites in trying to cast their ballots. So basically, this is just an example of how this kind of parallels with the literacy test and with the understanding clause, how sometimes blacks have to read more complex parts of the Constitution than whites had to. And basically just how it still goes on today, how they try to block it, black from voting. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the next section. Oh, no, I'm sorry. So, having heard this, do anyone change your mind? Do you still think that it's a problem today? Any of the people who are in the middle, or are you still in the middle?
I just have a question about whether it's conscious people trying to suppress the black vote, or whether it's just a symptom of the problem. Like people are actually, although I agree that it's unfair towards blacks, I have trouble thinking that people are actually consciously saying, okay, let's make sure that there are worse machines and let's close the polls a little bit earlier. And I listened to a lot on the radio when they were doing the the original voting, and there's a big debate over voter responsibility and where was the line between when voters just weren't educating themselves about the voting. So
that makes me ask like two questions. Like, one, is it less of a problem if it isn't a conscious decision, but it is a strong reality? Like, should the question be like, is it conscious, or should the question be like, you know, what is the problem? How do we solve the problem? Like, a lot of things have been a lot of instances of racism or discrimination or whatever have been not exactly like acts of volition. And then the second question that it makes me raise is that if we as a society realize that these are problems now, and we then choose not to do anything about it, and then we then choose not to ask the questions that are arising, then does it become like a cognizant effort to like not deal with the problem? Because we're aware of the problem when we don't deal with it.
Also, that's a good point, is that now that the problem is known and that it disproportionately affects people of color, now that we know that, if we don't solve it, then it is, we've made a non-decision that is a decision that has racial implications. The second thing is that some of the other things in that article that Martine didn't mention is that state troopers stopped vans that had been, carpools that had been organized to bring elderly black voters and people without cars to the polls, and they said, oh, you're acting as a taxi, you don't have a taxi license, and they gave them a ticket, and they set up blockades in front of, in the routes to the polling places, and they only stopped black-filled cars. They also asked, election officials asked black voters for ID, which you don't need. And if they didn't have it, they wouldn't let them vote. But then the white person behind them was not asked for any identification. So smaller scale, very deliberate instances have been documented of people. I mean, there's actually a white reporter who was at a polling place just doing the basic, it's election day, I'm going to be at this polling place. And a couple of black people said, come over here and film this. And the election officials ran her out of the polling station. And she went back to her station and tried to report this, and state troopers followed her all the way back to her station. And she testified for the NAACP hearing. So it was both a mix of deliberate and non-deliberate actions that produced the result.
Anybody else?
Okay.
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 In the same manner that blacks want to be able to vote and be accepted in the public sphere, black entertainers were looking for acceptance in their line of work as well. Len Fernando, part owner and senior editor of Black Hair Magazine, discusses black in the entertainment industry.
Hello, everybody. How many of you have heard of Ruby Dee? Oh, really? That's it? Okay. How many of you have seen Do the Right Thing? Jungle Fever? And more recently, Baby Geniuses? Okay, well, I recently wrote an article about Ruby Dee. She's an actress, a black actress, born in the 20s, a very prolific actress during the 60s and during the Civil Rights Movement. She's a screenwriter, a playwriter, a singer. She's done movies, she's done TV. And a lot is not known about her just because of the fact that she's black. She's a black actress. Those are just some of her films. She's done over 60 films in her life. Let me start out. Ruby Dee has been an actor and activist for over 60 years. With her husband, actor Ossie Davis, she has devoted her life to the struggle for civil rights and the entertainment and enlightenment of mass audiences. Her distinguished acting career alone testifies to her remarkable talents. How many actresses, let alone African-American actresses, have been able to stay in the spotlight for so long? But no matter how accomplished her career is, her greatest legacy will always be her unwavering support for equal rights for all, regardless of race and sex. Just a little bit about Ruby Dee. She was born in October 27th in Cleveland, Ohio. Her mother abandoned her, and she was raised by a father and a stepmother. And growing up in Harlem, the capital of black activism at the time, Ruby had a keen awareness of racism from an early age. Following the example of her stepmother, a school teacher and activist, she knew early on that she wanted to educate people and change their lives for the better. Theater was her outlet, and by her freshman year at Hunter College in New York, she was acting with the American Negro Theater. At this time, she befriended another talented performer and activist, Harry Belafonte, and the two became lifelong partners in fighting for civil rights. After a brief marriage to Frankie Dee, a promoter for a distillery, she met Ossie Davis when the two appeared together on Broadway. They were married 3 years later. They have been together ever since, acting together, protesting together, and raising 3 children. Like I said, just to name a few of her films, she's done The Jackie Robinson Story, where she was the wife, A Raisin in the Sun, the 1960 version, Gone Are the Days, and on TV, she has starred in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and Go Tell It on the Mountain, among many other projects. In 1998, she completed a joint autobiography with her husband entitled With Ossie and Ruby in This Life Together. And that just tops off over 30 projects they have collaborated on for stage, screen, TV, and radio. Together, they were inducted into the NAACP Image Award Hall of Fame in 1989. Ruby Dee is a well-known social activist and a member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dee speaks at many high-profile events, and having experienced firsthand the difficulties encountered by minorities in her profession, she established the Ruby Dee Scholarship in Dramatic Art for talented young black women. Having said all that, I just want to go around the room and ask people who comes to mind in terms of contemporary black actresses, and where do you know them from? Like, what kind of roles did they have? Do you want to start out?
Felicia Rashad, Cosby Show.
Okay. Another? Jada Pinkett. From what role do you know her most famous of?
Different World.
Okay. Jimmy?
Basketball, Best Man.
Okay.
Disappearing
Acts, too. Okay. Anybody else have any actresses in there?
Angela Bassett.
Angela Bassett. Okay, see, going through my mind, talking with the members of my group, it was really hard for me, or hard for us, to have a straight list of black actresses that are so well known, that are mainstream even, or that have won awards, Emmys, Oscars, Academy Awards, what have you.
Does anybody know any black actors or actresses who
have won Academy Awards? But at the same time, in thinking of that, how many negative roles have they played to get to where they are? Like, you know, they didn't immediately, you know. That's horrible. And that was Halle Berry. She's a very well-known actress. She's struck the mainstream, but at the same time, she had that. Jada Pinkett had Woo.
Whoa.
If you think about it in terms of Academy Awards, you can put four names under the black people who won Academy Awards for acting. Four out of almost 100 years of Oscar Awards.
And the Academy Awards have been on for 70 or more years, and I tried to look up, like, the archive actresses or black actors that have won, and there's little to none, like, acknowledgement or acceptance of black actors. And even the article at the Emmys, Ruby Dee's, talking about her nomination for an Emmy Award, and how she says, she's thinking, she's in the audience, and she says, black actresses for over a quarter of a century still waiting for the big break, tired of the neglect, indifference to material substance about black people, and I can only have 30 seconds. Because everyone was saying, oh, you're going to win the Emmy, you're definitely going to win it, but she didn't win it. Esther Rolle won it. And you know what her role was? She was a 79 version of a man. So what does that say about, like, roles and lead, like primary roles in the movies and the TV? Doesn't really say much in terms of positive portrayals or positive depictions of black women. So, should I do the first one or should I show this? Okay. All right, if everyone can stand up again.
Okay, let's go back.
So given Ruby Dee's arguments and some of the things discussed just here, question is?
Okay, first question basically is, do you think the opportunities in the entertainment sphere have improved, gotten worse, or remained the same for black actresses?
So gotten worse.
Improved over here, gotten worse, stayed.
And the same in the middle.
And about the same in the middle.
Or not sure.
Since Ruby D.
You guys gotta spread out so we know what's what, like who's where.
You guys have to take over.
Over here is improvement.
Roles and opportunities have improved. Roles and depictions, opportunities have gotten worse. Not sure, or they're about the same. Okay, who's, this is all improved? This is the center. Are you gotten worse?
No, see, I'm on the cusp of gotten worse. I'm on the cusp. That's what I am.
All right, Tiffany, why do you feel that it hasn't even gotten any better? There's been no.
Why am I on the cusp?
Yeah.
Because they still will not do a good black drama where you see a black family for real in the situations of everyday life. They have to always comedy it up. And that's why, in my mind, that it's still, because they won't. You never see the real truth. You always see gloss pictures. Moesha, that's not the truth. She irks me. Partners, that's not how things are really going to happen in a black family for real. And the good shows that they do have about black families, about black life, is on cable and it comes on late at night and you hardly ever see it. And if you saw, like, Dancing with September, you'll understand what I'm talking about, because that was, that you know, that just lets you know what's happening. So, hey, I'm right here on the cusp.
Okay. Now, I have a question for you, though. Did you like Waiting to Exhale?
Did I like Waiting? No, because I thought them women were dumb. I thought those women were stupid.
Now, there were four.
And none of them have no sense when it came to a man.
Thin Line Between Love and Hate, Linda Whitfield.
That was crazy.
She was crazy. There are all these negative portrayals of black act, like black women.
And is she really going to go stalking after Martin Lawrence? Let's
go to the improvement and go to the improvement.
Stay the same, or are the same.
I'm kind of borderline. Stay the same, gotten worse. Because I was about to say, if you want to compare it to, like, the menstrual times, of course it's gotten better, but when you think about it, it really hasn't, because our society has changed so much. I don't feel like, I think we just move with the time. Like, if we were at like a 2, we just, now we're like the 2000 version of a 2. Mm-hmm. It's gotten better compared to how it was, but back then it was like, I mean, that, you know, our society was so much worse than racism.
I was thinking that, like, of course it's gotten better, you know, how could it not have, but you have to put things on scales, and, like, on the level we're at now, like, it should be better.
What about improvement?
I wouldn't say definite. You use the word definite improvement, and that's totally not out there, and so I guess somewhere I should be on the line between improved and somewhat stayed the same. Because you've gotten to the point where at this time, black actresses are being pulled into mainstream movies and television roles, but at the same time, there hasn't been that many of them. It's been a very, very slow process. And while at the same time, it's interesting. Just throwing out an example, Lila Rashawn, I believe, some movie she was interesting, she was talking about where she's paired as the lead against a white actor. And when it was originally written, there was supposed to be a romantic interest there, but once they put her there as the lead actress, romantic interest goes out the window. So I think while there has been some very small gradual improvement, there's still a lot that needs to be done.
I agree with there's definitely a long way to go, but I definitely think there's been a lot of improvement, especially over just the last decade. You know, we moved from Sal Carter and Give Me a Break to, you know, the Wayans Brothers and shows on
TV's
not real.
Yeah, because then again,
and my feeling is not the Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
there's like the Cosby Show and stuff, but there's also like the same type of thing that's not, you know,
I think that you made a good point that, like, when we're talking about television, and then, like, when we talk about how, like, television shows that reflect black life don't accurately reflect black life, that television is not an accurate representation of life anyway. So I think that that was a very important point that you brought up a moment ago.
But
we're gonna
cut the discussion out. We're gonna discuss, like, have a bigger discussion at the end after we, like, all do our presentations, so we can tie it in, but.
Okay, right now I'm just going to show you two different clips actually. One of them is called Ethnic Notions, and it's discussing like the history of black entertainment and how they were portrayed in films, like the minstrelsy, the mammies, and see the evolution in the second clipping of black entertainment, black entertainers in general, and black actors and actresses, and see maybe like if there has been a change, and see if you guys want to cross the line.
Cartoons like this popularize the belief that black Americans have descended from savages.
To use the 19th century cliche, which prevailed almost up to our own time, Africa was the dark continent. It was the place where civilization had made the least progress. Indeed, it was the center of anti-civilization, or primitivism of all kinds.
According to myth, slavery, then segregation, had managed to domesticate black Americans. But without white control, blacks reverted to savagery. In the 1920s and 30s, the savage stereotype acquired a new dimension.
Whether you're a white man, I come and I go, and that's my business.
I'm afraid to stand right up to your
betters
and tell
them what's what. There was a lot of talk about the new Negro during the 1920s, of blacks being able to assert their manhood, their independence. But at the same time, there was a strain of the older ideas that persisted. The idea of reversion to savagery, except that savagery was now redefined.
Don't you all know that I've got a song? Takes a silver bullet to kill Brutus Jones.
A very good example of this would be the Emperor Jones. The sort of notion that if blacks were true to themselves, they would be noble savages perhaps, but still savages. So again, you're dealing with a stereotype, except you're taking the stereotype of the black savage and you're kind of giving it a more positive evaluation.
Oh, Lord,
The more comforting images of the mammy, Sambo, and uncle posed no threat. Happily, they entertained and served. Through this romantic fantasy, generations of Americans from the Civil War to this day escaped concern or responsibility for racism.
Way down south in Dixie, where dancing is a natural heritage of the Negro.
From the beginning, popular entertainment was dominated by dancing, singing, darting.
This next take is kind of shaky, but it just shows like some more images and some also like current images today that you see on television that kind of resemble or
emotions. I'll show you what I mean.
The mammy, the piccaninny, the coon, the sambo, the...
Shoes on, don't watch it, I guess, for I'm the luckiest coon in this town.
That's what you are.
Against a broad spectrum of time warp.
Excuse me, fellas. It's nice to meet you. My name is Victor LaCroix. I work in accounting here. Luther, I really like what you're doing.
Zip Coon.
Friends, that
psychological, irrationality. A dandy and a buffoon. Zip Coon's attempts to imitate whites mocked the notion of racial equality.
Together. I guess I can keep it together. I'm keeping it together. I'm K-I-T-K. Keep it together. I'm keeping it together right now. Keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. Keep it together, I'm keeping it together. Throw it together.
Have you heard any more voices?
Perceive their minstrel stage as a doorway out of hunger, a doorway out of the South, a doorway.
15 minutes. Oh, man, I gotta cut a brother in on that, man. Let me be now, man. We'll split it three ways. 7 for me, 7 for you, and you get whatever left over, man, because you've been tripping ever since I met you, man, for real.
Hey, Fush, I'm from the bars.
Wait a minute, man. Oh, let's go to that, man. Hey, forget about what I said. Hey, I don't know shit about no $15 million, no Jaguar. Forget about that shit.
Images.
Please be careful, somebody get hurt. Just got hit for a piece of switch. Woo! Piece of switch. I thought we were going down. Piece of switch.
Okay, now after seeing all of that, have people sentiments about black entertainers in general change? Do people still think it's gotten better, or have people?
And think about too, like those, like not images that weren't even on there, because that's kind of old, I think. But think about like the Wayans brothers, how they just make a fool of themselves on TV. The PJs, which is just like black menstruals for the 2G.
I just have one thing to say. Like some of those, like are comedies, and they were like meant to be that. And then we have like some black serious roles that like counteract that. Just like people would say something if we wanted to do the same thing and show like white actors, people would say that Jim Carrey or somebody represented, you know, the best of what like white actors could be. That was just.
Well, we're saying like we understand. Like, but the difference between like black actors and actresses and a white actor and actresses is that they're represented in a full spectrum, and like we as a black, like black people are not represented in that full spectrum, that we don't get, like most of our black men, you can, like an interesting study would be count the number of serious roles in movies that black men have played, and then the number of roles that black men have played that are like the Chris Tucker role and the Martin Lawrence roles that we see on every, like the movies that come out.
I agree. I was just saying,
yeah.
You know, somebody
would
play them.
Yeah, argue that, yeah.
Maybe this is like a topic for later, like broader discussion, but I also think you have to look at both of these questions, you have to look at like, the larger context and with the voting and with the entertainment business. Like, of course, there are going to be improvements in the black industry because there are more people who own theaters like Magic, or people who can produce their own films and stuff like that. So, of course, you're going to get a deeper portrayal and see that there's not any improvement at all. It's just like ridiculous, you know. You can't discredit like Cicely Tyson and Sandra and those other films that just have made a definite impact and have shown drama without any comedic aspects, you know. And I think you can't just say just because it doesn't blow up in the mainstream, you know. And there are plenty of films that open, they don't get any support from the audience at all, and they have to close because, you know, nobody goes to see them.
I just wanted to say that, like, when we look at like the images of, like, since you brought up, like, the images of, like, blacks versus whites in the media and, like, you know, what we see, like, I think that indistinguishable from those roles are the control of these images. Black people do not tend to control the images of black people, and I think that, like, that's something to take into consideration. Not that I'm claiming, like, I feel like there's a difference now between, like, the buffoonery or whatever you want to say today, because there is like a choice involved with it, whereas in the past there wasn't necessarily that choice. But like, you can't, I don't think you can talk about these issues without talking about like who's controlling the images that we see.
Well, I was going to say the same thing, because, well, I was going to ask the question, if you keep bringing up the Wayans brothers, like, I don't watch it, but what I gather is no one's making them do this. This is like what they want to do, you know. But then we see these tapes of like, you know, a long time ago, and they didn't have the choice to do this. Like, people, this was their way of like not being like a slave or whatever, you know. This was their way of breaking out, and they did whatever they had to do to, you know, even if they didn't approve it, or if they, you know, if it wasn't what they wanted to do, they did it anyway. But now I feel like, unless I'm wrong, correct me if I am, because I don't know, how I just feel like people like the Wayans brothers are.
Think about that, the choices that they're offered, like the role, like they're only offered so many things. Like the Wayans brothers, like they want to stay on WB, like that's their station or network that they're affiliated with. They're aware, consciously aware of what they're doing, but if they're only offered, like, you have to have your program like this, like they're not free, like they're not totally free.
I'm asking, like, are they.
Well, I think the question that's being here, that's at issue here, is what realm of choice is truly available? Mm-hmm. And when you think about that, you have to think about the power structure of the television industry in Hollywood. Now, how many of you can name a black person who owns a movie studio?
Just be
able to
last week. He doesn't own a studio.
He tried to buy NBC, but people didn't want to buy NBC. Can anybody name a black studio executive in Hollywood?
Quincy Jones.
I'm wrong. Well, Quincy Jones has his own entertainment vehicles, but he's not the head of a studio like Paramount. Can anyone name, other than Spike Lee, a black film director? John Singleton, Robert Townsend. Okay, we've got three blind men here. The Hughes Brothers. Okay, what movies have they put out in the last 5 years? How many?
Besides Spike, she's in
it. Besides Spike?
Two and then she's in New York Undercover.
John Singleton did put out a movie that I was surprised that he directed, but I don't think it was
in it. His last movie,
where was it?
He didn't have any black actors.
He
did have
black
actors. He's a small production company that has ties to Paramount.
And they produced or co-produced Scary Movie.
So,
well, I know it wasn't the best player, but it was a big hit.
No, I'm just saying, it is a big hit. I mean, there's a couple of questions. I just want to unravel them before we move to the next point about Control. So we had a hard time. There are no black movie studios that independently produce films. Even Spike Lee's films are in conjunction with Paramount, I believe. So in terms of who has the money to produce film and who owns the studio space and everything like that, that's all basically white folks.
But can we really name white people who own
films? But they own them. It's common knowledge that they own them.
Well, I mean, but I couldn't bring them off the top of my head.
No, but they
white
own them.
Well, think about Steven Spielberg's company. Think about Zanuck. Think about Michael Eisner, who owns Disney, ABC, and that includes Miramax and Touchstone. And Miramax's head is Harvey Weinstein. I mean, I've just rattled off six or seven names of white people. I mean, you can't go through Hollywood and television without noticing that every CEO, every major producer is white. And there's enough evidence out there that shows that when black actors and actresses are thought of for roles that are colorblind roles, it shifts the script significantly. So the example you gave up, the love interest drops out. Did anybody see The Pelican Brief?
Mm-hmm.
Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington? They're supposed to have a love affair. Do you ever see them kiss or naked in bed together? It was cut out because they thought audiences weren't ready for that. So these ideas of who the audience is and what they're ready for. When Waiting to Exhale took tons of years to put together, it wasn't until Whitney Houston, okay, even with Angela Bassett and all those other good actresses, it wasn't until Whitney Houston signed on, because they thought, oh, crossover appeal. She has lots of white music fans, so maybe they'll come to the movie studio. They'll come to the movies as well. It wasn't until she signed on that movie could be made. It's a million bestseller book being made into a movie, and people thought, a movie about four black women, nobody will go see it. And nobody meant white people won't go see it. So if you look at the market research that gets done, and if you look at the struggles that black scriptwriters and filmmakers have had in getting their films made and raising money, there's still a climate that white people are only ready to see blacks in particular ways. And so even with the success of Waiting to Exhale and The Best Man, you don't all of a sudden see a slew of multicultural films coming out every year. If you look at all the Oscar nominees, if you look at the top 10 grossing films, sometimes you have people of color in significant roles there. But even with that box office success, it hasn't resulted in kind of like a watershed. Like every couple of years you get do-do-do-do-do, and then it kind of goes away. So if you look at the patterns actually of cast and filmmaking and television making, I mean, after The Cosby Show, the number one show ever in history, more viewers than any other show, even Ozzie and Harriet, even The Honeymoon, any show in television history. And what does NBC have on its docket that has an all-black cast? Nothing. It made NBC billions of dollars and still making billions of dollars in syndication.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of whether or not success or whether or not people come isn't necessarily what the decision making is about, because people of color are still seen as a risk for a lot of people in the industry. That's why, you know, Latinos are the largest non-white group in the country. How many Latino shows do you see on TV? Asians are the number one immigration. Their rates are going up. Hugest group of immigrants we have other than Latinos coming to this country. See, can you name an Asian person other than Lucy Liu on Ally McBeal who has a major role on a network television show? Can you name anyone?
I can name someone who used to.
Who used to?
Dustin Nguyen, he was on Sequest.
Okay, on Sequest. Well, Sequest got dumb. Sequest was very multiple.
It was good.
Because it was in
good.
The future.
Yeah, it was good. It was really good.
So if you think of it in those terms.
No, Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine is a
pretty good one. He's a cast member right now.
So if you think in these terms, not just black, white, but all peoples of all colors, you know. Asian people got money, Latino people got money, black people got money, all of us watch TV. You know, you're all here in this class together, no big problem.
Minorities watch more TV than
exactly.
Black people.
So the WB and UPN and Fox couldn't have been successful without minority viewers because they were putting on Martin, they were putting on In Living Color, and this drew huge audiences completely mixed. So but still, it seems like UPN and WB are the two networks where you can, are the only two where you can consistently find casts with lots of black faces, rather than just one here, one there. You know, Dr. Peter, what's his face on ER, or Gideon, whatever. So if you think of it in more global terms, and you think about the kind of decision-making processes that are behind economic and cultural decision-making processes, it's pretty clear from the research that I know that if you think in terms of proportionality, if you think in terms of economics, there's really no concrete reason why we don't see a more multicultural media landscape in terms of the mainstream. And that's nothing for anybody to feel guilty about personally, but it's something to think about in terms of your consumption habits. So, let us move on to our next set.
Number one reader that's in your course pack, Sarah Wright noted that one can hardly pick up a book which does not advertise naked or suggestively naked African American women, and we just happen to have Divide magazine like sitting up here in Amazon, use it for her presentation, and I just started flipping through the magazine and like I just found so many like just suggestively just African American women, like, and this is a magazine that's targeted at
African American.
Yeah, African American, but all through the magazine, there's pictures like this. There's pictures with less clothing on. She also notes that in popular music of our time, it is in what she calls a supreme state of chaos, and she says that the reduction of women in song to mere sexual animals is at the point beyond which it can go no further. So she's saying like
now this is in
1966. So we know today I was just sitting here thinking of songs that okay I have in my CD player right now, and one song is Uchi Wally Wally. I know y'all heard like well a lot of y'all heard the song Uchi Wally by QB's Finest. I know what I'm talking about, like, and it, the song is really sexy suggestive. I don't know if you've seen the videos, like four guys, you know. I had a CD, so I mean I was just thinking like what's that saying, but it's like four guys in the video, they're just surrounded by all these beautiful women who are in bikinis, and basically they're talking about screwing all these girls. I thought about the thong song, which probably more of you guys know, and he's talking about that the girl got dumps like a truck, and guys like wouldn't tell her to move her butt and let him see her thong, and I mean, this is the music that we're listening to, but she's saying it's in 1966, but we're like, just think about how bad guys are bad, and just think about some of the CDs that you guys might have, and like some of the lyrics today. How they're like sexually degrading the women. In the children's reading, Paul Marshall states that the Negro woman has been until recent times almost non-existent in prose literature. So we're moving on to talking about books now. And he wasn't saying that black women do not appear, but he was saying that they don't appear in a reality, like almost like we're talking about on TV, how what Timmy was saying about how they the black people don't appear like in real, like how they really are. He was saying that in the literature,
she was.
Oh, she was saying her. Oh, I was.
Is it spelled with an E? Okay, so she was saying, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That the image that does appear is a sheer myth, stereotype, and a fantasy figure, which has very little to do with black women in reality. This was also written in 1966. She's saying the predominantly two depictions of black women that have been prevalent. The first is the nigger wench. And I don't know if you guys, when Lynn first turned on that video, it was a lady that she had on the white nurse's uniform. She her first turned on Ethnic Notion. She had big wet brush. She was skinny. That's like the nigger wench type woman. She's sensual, primitive, pleasure-seeking, immoral, the siren, the sinner type girl. The second, which was depicted much more in black literature, was that the black matriarch, who was humble, devoted, devoutly religious, patient, and what they call demanding.